Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
What is the third world? The term has essentially been scrubbed from our collective consciousness. What once used to be something concrete, it seems to have vanished into thin air. Today, the term world seems to be, quote, a closed chapter in world history. But my guests today are determined that it not remain so. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. I'm joined by historians Gyan Prakash and Jeremy Edelman, co-editors of a new volume titled Inventing the Third World, In Search of Freedom for the Post-War Global South. Gyan is the Dayton Stockton Professor of History and was a member of the influential Subaltern Studies Collective until its dissolution in 2006. His recent books include Mumbai Fables, which was adapted for the 2015 film Bombay Velvet, and Emergency Chronicles, Indira Gandhi and Democracy's Turning Point. Jeremy is the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History and director of the Global History Lab at Princeton. His recent books include Worldly Philosopher, The Odyssey of Albert O. Hirschman, and the forthcoming Earth Hunger, Global Integration, and the Need for Strangers. Gyan and Jeremy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So we begin at the beginning. You began your careers as specialists of two different world regions, Gyan specializing in the history of South Asia and Jeremy in the history of Latin America. So I want to ask each of you, when in your work or at what point in your journey has the questions that this book is raising about the third world, when did they come to you and when did they begin to seem meaningful questions for you? Maybe, Gyan, we can begin with you.
Okay, so, you know, I've been studying colonialism for a long time. And my impression was that since Edward Said's work, when post-colonial studies emerged, much of its focus was on how there was an urge for another world, for a world after empire, under colonialism. And much of the work that was done by post-colonial studies was mainly by literary scholars initially. And, you know, I edited a volume in 1995 called After Colonialism, which emerged out of a conference we did at Princeton in the Davis Center on empire. And the volume had largely articles by literary scholars. And it was about how there was an urge for the beyond under colonialism. But then later on, I began to feel that, you know, while that was very useful, there wasn't actually that much work, particularly by historians, on actually existing post-colonial societies. And so I started actually a course called After Empire in 2015 and did a conference. And out of that emerged a volume that I co-edited with Michael Laffin, who works on Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean, called The Postcolonial Moment, which was also published by Bloomsbury. And the focus there was really on looking at the postcolonial moment as a moment caught between no longer and not yet. And so it was an ambivalent moment, and We looked at various societies in South and Southeast Asia and how they tried to frame the future in terms of states, economic policies, and so on and so forth. You know, so I was working with this, and then I started working on the emergency in India in 1975. And much of the historiography was, it was all because of Indira Gandhi. You know, she was an authoritarian, unlike her father, Jawaharlal Nehru. She didn't have commitment to democracy, and it was all because of her. And it was a momentary episode in Indian history. And when it ended, the path resumed. And I sort of knew that was wrong. So I started looking at the emergency in its kind of a longer time frame. And it seemed to me, you know, going back to the work that I had done on the post-colonial moment, that 1975 was a kind of a last-ditch attempt to salvage the post-colonial project. And that by that time, something new had emerged. And I looked at, you know, I mean, what was happening in India was not just happening in India. Globally, one could, you know, as everyone knows, from the 1960s onwards, you see a kind of a turmoil. 1968, Paris, guerrilla movements in Latin America, counterculture in the US, you know, turmoil in Pakistan, formation of Bangladesh, Trotskyist movement in Sri Lanka, Maoism. And in India itself, I could see that, you know, by the late 60s and early 70s, there was a kind of a generational change, both in art and in politics. And there was an urge to both look back at the kind of failed dreams of colonialism, as well as looking forward and trying to chart something new. So that led me to think that, you know, there was a kind of an internationalism that was part of anti-colonialism, but that took a kind of a new shape by the 60s and 70s. I mean, I remember I was a student in Delhi in the early 70s, and I remember doing a play by an Italian playwright called Mario Frati on Che. And that play was really about how the old communist parties were corrupt and so on, and, you know, part of a new revolution. And so it was very kind of internationalist. I mean, I remember in the early 70s, you know, going on demonstration for Angela Davis and, you know, carrying posters of, you know, Ho Chi Minh and so on. So, I mean, I think I remembered all of this, and I thought, well, you know, it would be good to look at what was that moment of, you know, the third world, a new kind of internationalism. And that's what, I mean, I think the conversation with Jeremy kind of led to, you know, thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I had, you know, kind of some similar experiences to Gyan's, although I was coming at it from a very different angle. I mean, I didn't grow up in India, but I grew up in Canada, and then spent a lot of time in Latin America in my youth. But for the same reasons, the underlying questions behind the book have been there in a sense all along from the late 70s. For me, they were connected perhaps more to issues around development rather than questions of colonial legacy. Obviously, and this is really reflects some of the differences between the prisms that you would get if you worked and lived in Latin America compared to, say, India. So connected to development and the debates in Latin America about its place in the wider world as kind of quote unquote peripheral or quote unquote dependent. So that acknowledging the very different kinds of experiences with capitalism of living in the world was important to register. And for that reason, and this is what Gyan was alluding to, these were also areas of the world that had very clear, that was the source of very clear alternative visions and dreams for what that world order might look like. And so what animated this project, the conversations that Gian and I had, was you know, the search for a kind of different global history, you know, one that would identify the ways in which Europe was not the only source of imagining worlds, and that this quote-unquote space, this space called the quote-unquote third world, was generating this. So we were very interested in the kind of the history of world making. And I think for both of us, what we're saying is that's always been there. It just got pulverized by the effects of the late Cold War and post-Cold War, and we were trying to recover it.
Yeah, and I think we'll delve a little bit deeper into that question of why now, why this project now in particular. But before that, maybe we can set a little bit of a groundwork for our listeners. So I wanted to set some temporal frameworks first for what we're talking about. And this volume, which has 12 chapters, an introduction and a coda, it grows out of a conference that was held at Princeton. And the years that you chose to define the periodization of this conference were 1948 to 1979. And I'm interested to hear you speak about the choice, particularly maybe 1948, as a temporal framework to begin addressing these questions and revisiting this history of the third world.
Jeremy, you want to take this?
Sure, I'll grab it. You know, the term third world itself has a history. It's coined in the early 1950s, actually by a French demographer. It's really initially meant not in entirely celebratory ways, right? That the third world was the leftover world of the colonial societies. He was a friend, Alfred Sauvy was the man who coined it, was a French demographer and alarmed about what would happen with the combination of decolonization and population growth, especially in North Africa, which is what he was observing very closely. And so for a French demographer, in the wake of the Second World War, these kinds of changes represented a change for France and for Europe. And the term gets embraced, right? As it gets in some senses flipped and as a kind of label of affirmation or demand for recognition. I think we'll talk a lot about that. And so it emerges out of the post Second World War era and the crisis of European and to some extent the Japanese Empire, and so combinations of independence in India, new thinking about development and industrialization in Latin America, the creation of new institutions to promote these, and these in a sense crest by the late 1970s, dreaming of a new international economic order in the 1970s. OPEC and so on, but these come in some senses crashing down by the end of that decade. That the dreams that were so powerful in motivating these alternative visions of the world, in the pursuit of a post-colonial future of freedom, of development, of equality, of membership, of recognition, those in a sense got smashed. We would kind of would argue with the dawn of something we might call the neoliberal era, right? So that explains that what we would call in history kind of the periodization is to recapture that moment. It's worth saying you mentioned Lisa the conference that we held at Princeton and you know, for listeners, they maybe this is just a footnote at this stage, but it was the last conference I remember we were holding it and thinking about dreaming. And it was a very powerful conference. It was also when we knew COVID was descending on us. And there was a palpable feeling that we may not be together in the same room. So we were recovering things, but there was also a sense of closure in the book, in the conference itself. And at the very end, I think the comments where we're wrapping things up, kind of acknowledging that it may be a long time before people could come back together and talk to each other about ideas and history. Anyway, so that explains the periodization. Did I leave anything out there, Gian?
No, I mean, I think you are right about the conference itself, that, you know, actually when we first organized the conference, there was no actually thought about doing a book. And it was the conference itself which generated this sort of also a new kind of solidarity in the conference itself. That led us to think that we need to sort of think about what was this kind of imagination of the third world? Because in a way, you know, in popular conversation by now, you know, third world is often used pejoratively. People often say, oh, this people used to say about LaGuardia, you know, oh, the airport is like a third world airport, you know. It was always meant pejoratively. And I always thought that, you know, third world had a much more imaginative, aspirational quality to it. And in a sense, the conference captured that. And so we thought, well, you know, it has to begin with the moment when it emerges as this kind of aspirational term, which is really kind of the end of formal empire in after Second World War. And then it continues till, you know, the late 70s. And it's also interesting that, you know, when it ends in the late 70s, it is also a moment of its kind of a high imagination. I mean, that's when, you know, the new world economic order ideas comes through. I mean, all this is happening precisely at a moment it's also going to kind of plummet, you know. So I thought, you know, those two signposts were kind of important.
So if the temporal markers are, you know, after the Second World War and right up to the beginning of the neoliberal era or the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, what are the geographic markers? Because one of the things that I learned, you know, having my focus is in African history. And so one of the things that this book drove home for me was particularly Cindy Ewing's chapter that the third world, she identifies a British observer of a conference in 1947 who uses the term first, let's say. And that the third world comes out of a nugget, sort of post-colonial activism and rethinking that's happening in centered around Asian politics. And so we have a kind of expansion of the third world from an origin in a new Asia project, expanding into Afro-Asian solidarities, to the non-aligned movement, and then to the tricontinental, including Latin America, in 1966. And so maybe you can talk us through a little bit the expansion or the changes of this geographical imaginary of what the third world was to include.
Yeah, I mean, Cindy's chapter, yes, as you said, it kind of lays out how initially it was sort of really Asian and Afro-Asian bloc that geographically thinks of this idea of the third world. And, you know, one can think of, you know, between Bandung in 1955 and the Tricontinental in Cuba in 1966, and you see the kind of expansion of the term, where the third world now geographically includes Asia, Africa, Latin America. But I would emphasize more than its kind of a geographic references to really the idea of another world. Because, you know, I think in Fanon, for example, where he repeatedly, you know, uses the term the third world, the Wretched of the Earth ends up with, you know, comrades, let's, you know, build a new humanity, a new humanism for ourselves, for Europe, for everyone. So, I mean, there is an urge for an imagination of really a new life after empire. And that new life for empire is not geographically bounded, but really aims at creating you know, a new kind of world order. I mean, one of the things that I find striking, even about nationalism, is that, you know, it was always concerned with some idea of newness. To give you one example, Gandhi's journal was called Young India. His press was called Navjeevan Press, which is New Life Press. So there was this kind of idea that, you know, after empire, there will be a kind of a new life, a new world. And that new world was not geographically bounded, but really kind of imaginative about creating something new.
I would add, you know, I agree, obviously, with everything that Jan just said. I would add that, you know, it's a story that has multiple origin points. Even if it has one term, it comes out of thinking that Africans, Asians, Latin Americans are generating, even if they aren't necessarily connected to each other. And one of the remarkable stories, and this is why the importance of, in Cindy's piece, and Gian has alluded to some of these key events like Bandung and Tricontinental and particular moments like the Cuban Revolution that begin to spark exchanges between these places that have their own origin point for dreaming about alternative post-colonial, let's say, systems or world orders. And these new practices of diplomacy and exchange that crisscross the world and integrate this space without necessarily Europe or the United States being at the center of it. And most of the practices of what we would call world or global history tended to start from, you know, the European institutions or the American institutions and that radiate outwards and connect the world up. And we were very interested in looking at these, what we would now call South-South exchange systems and networks that emerged to produce from these various origin points something that became a shared imaginary, not always the same, but at least had some common elements to it. That meant doing a very different kind of global intellectual history than is the norm.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about those kind of key moments like Bandung, where I've always found Richard Wright's kind of small essay in his volume Color Curtain, his reporting on Bandung, very interesting, where at one point he says, referring to the conference, that, you know, it was a meeting that no political scientist, no anthropologist, no sociologist could have ever imagined. And he says it was almost utopian. What brought these, as he calls it, black men, yellow men, Asians, Africans together? There was nothing in their sort of, let's say, society or religion that could explain why they had come together. What they had in common was a colonial experience. So how that experience becomes the basis for forging these kinds of global solidarities and imagining a new world is something that he really kind of pinpoints. And I think he kind of captures what was unique about Bandung.
So these are histories of connectivity that are going beyond and across and cutting through the kind of established systems of connectivity that history had foregrounded, right? So the superpowers or empire, rather this is the internationalism of the Third World Project is really fundamental. And you underline that in the introduction. And one thing I found quite notable about this volume was that this connectivity internationalism, as much as it was, say, publicized and happened at conferences, where even if political scientists and anthropologists couldn't have imagined it, they would certainly have recognized, you know, its clear importance. There's also so much circulation and connectivity around exchanges of cultural production, of intellectual production, and the volume really does include attention to film, to literature, to art, to novels. And so I wonder at what point in your conversations you thought that foregrounding this kind of cultural and intellectual histories aspect was just as important as the geopolitical or more straightforward political history of the conferences.
Yeah, why don't you take this one?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the literature, it seemed that the whole idea of the Third World had largely been dealt with by political scientists and in terms of geopolitics or, you know, non-aligned movement, UN and so on. And we thought that really, if you look at how people were imagining this kind of internationalism, new kind of a globalism, there was a kind of a movement from below, which focused a great deal on art, literature, cinema, and so on. So, you know, you take the example of Cinema Novo in Brazil and that kind of a documentary style that they fashion, you find echoes of that happening in India. You find there lots of kind of exchanges that are happening at the level of art, culture. And so, for example, Ethre Gupta's essay in our volume talks about, you know, Souza, who starts with the progressive artist group in Bombay in the 40s and then moves to London and does these kind of paintings called black paintings, where he argues that, you know, to see the color black, you have to contort your body. You can't just, you know, look at sort of painting on the wall in a traditional museum, but you have to distort yourself in order to see it. And that distortion has to do with the particular history of blackness and connected to slavery and so on. So we found that, you know, a lot of these really creative things that were happening at the level of imagining the Third World was in the realm of art, music, culture, and so on. And so we actually invited people to the conference and then to the volume who were working on art, culture, because I thought there was something there that was both more enduring, but also more fleeting. And so it didn't really enter the kind of standard accounts about the Third World, which was largely about, you know, non-aligned conference, Commonwealth conference, and so on and so forth.
And connected to a narrative of failure. This goes back to a point that you had made earlier, Lisa, about the ways in which, you know, as one historian has called, the condescension of posterity is applied to the term, you know, Third World. You know, it was seen as a project that somehow failed, and that is connected to, let's say, economic policies or political processes and so on. And what we wanted to recover are some of the legacies that got buried along with that condescension that were aesthetic and experimental, that were very important to this world making, you know, motivation that brought people together, that had to do with their new practices of representation of themselves and of each other to each other in different kinds of ways. It would be hard to imagine the magical realist novel out of Latin America without connecting up to these processes that Guillaume talked about, and the way even that genre itself spread to India and the influence of Mao, you know, with the idea of rupturing history comes to Latin America. And so how to recapture those exchange networks that go through writers, musicians, photographers, and so on. And I think it's really important to underline the importance of displacement and exile in all of this, because with it come these very disruptive moments for artists and intellectuals out of the quote unquote Third World that put them in contact with each other in very intimate ways that also catalyze the exchanges elsewhere. To kind of recapture that that often escape those normal channels of, you know, the famous prizes and the famous cultural conventions that Europeans and Americans produce. That is also what this book is trying to recover.
Yeah, the word that is used, you know, a few times in the introduction, I think the idea of the imaginary. And that's very much what feels that the emphasis of this volume takes seriously in a way that other previous discussions of the third world maybe had relegated a little bit to the background. So this book is coming out in 2023. It is born, let's say, at a conference, very appropriate, just before COVID fully comes out into the open. And how does, you know, the process of going through this is as the globalization that we've become so used to in from the end of the Cold War onwards is in some senses very palpably breaking down, not only with the pandemic, but also with the rise of populism or the putting into consideration, to reconsideration, the idea that all these offshore supply chains are a great thing that make us stronger rather than make us weaker. So we're here in this moment of reconsidering globalization's forward march and its flattening of the world. And you're producing this volume in its kind of peak reconsideration, the period of the pandemic. What does the history of the third world tell us or shed light on regarding the place that this neoliberal globalization that we're surrounded by, how does it reframe thinking about globalization now that globalization is itself being kind of questioned?
I think if we have a, and maybe we can kick this around, if we have a presentist agenda, which I do, and I'm not ashamed.
PHA is going on right now. So,
you know, is partly in trying to recover this moment and voices and actors, is also to convey a different sense of the global. If we are in the moment now where, and I think this comes up in both the introduction and the coda, and it's implicit in a lot of the essays, if we are going to exploit this moment to rethink the global in the wake of a particular very strong and dominant narrative, which we called globalization, and that word itself was coined not by the Harvard Business Review, but it was in fact coined by the North-South Commission that started to work in the late 1970s, published its report in 1980, and it coins this term globalization, which calls for a new world order of disarmament and equality and co-membership. And of course, it gets buried by the debt crisis and everything else of the 1980s and the what happened in 1989. But to recover this idea of alternative globals, alternative ways of thinking about world order with a different vocabulary, with different practices of storytelling and representation. And this is a moment in which we have to have a different conversation about it. And we might look back and say there were actors and practices and institutions on the stage even back then, when the liberal system was getting institutionalized, that we've forgotten about, that might help us rethink our moment now. And so instead of burying quote unquote globalization, to rethink it because the fact is we live in an interdependent world, and this is something that that the third world voices were trying to argue for, thinking about what dependency was on this scale. And that was often seen in kind of pathological ways. Dependency was bad and we needed to be autonomous and independent. In fact, we now recognize that we're all dependent in some senses on each other across borders. And that vocabulary alone, that thinking about what colonialism meant and its legacies and being dependent will be helpful for thinking about our present. So, I think that that's an important component to to recall for readers as they would approach the rethinking of this moment and that the book tries to illuminate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we certainly didn't want to do, and we say that in the introduction as well, is, you know, to do something like The World We Have Lost. Not an act of nostalgia. Look, you know, there was this wonderful moment and we lost it, and rise and fall. I mean, that's not what we want to do. And in a way, you know, the critique of kind of globalization that's emerged in the wake of COVID crisis, I would say, in fact, since the 2008-09 global financial crisis, that's made, you know, some of these arguments more sort of palatable to people. But I mean, I was thinking more in sort of a Benjaminian terms, in the sense that when, you know, history says that the past is dead, it's past, it's history, it's finished. So third world is finished, it's dead. In fact, what is happening is that what is rubbished as, you know, debris and past is part of the present. So this idea of globalization based on markets and, you know, shopping and so on comes into being and becomes dominant by rubbishing this other idea of globalism. And so it rubbishes it, but it's very much part of the kind of present history. And so we wanted to kind of recover it to say, look, this is another part of globalism that was rubbished by this market orthodoxy of globalism, but that is very much present. And we can see that now, you know, maybe it was brought by the COVID crisis, but now there's sort of a questioning of this idea of, you know, we'll all be together through market and, you know, the market will solve everything. And so I think this is a moment to think about the world that was rubbished and as discarded, as obsolete, and say, no, it's there. And, you know, that's what we need to look at.
What's paradoxical is that it was, you know, as Gyan is suggesting, it was so ridiculed for so long, right? And the paradox is that now people are desperately looking for, you know, languages of solidarity, not just convenience, equality, not just supply chains, peace. I mean, there's actually a lot in the book about peace and disarmament and thinking about the end to armed conflict. There are a lot of, say, coordinates in that long moment of alternative thinking and imaginings. Not necessarily to go back and recover for our present, but to say there was a history of these things that we buried and forgot for decades, that could give us a different genealogy through the present and into the future, and a different story of the world if we could, you know, open up these doors and windows into these actors.
I mean, really, I agree entirely with Jeremy on this, because, you know, I just taught a course this past semester to undergraduates. And these are, you know, what, juniors and seniors, you know, 20, 21-year-olds. I taught this undergraduate course on World After Empire, and largely teaching Fanon, Albert Memmi, you know, kind of a classic anti-colonial thinkers. And I can't tell you how eager the students are, the young students are, about kind of new ideas without the kind of a Cold War lens. I mean, I remember teaching some of these things about 20 years ago, and there was always this kind of shadow of the Cold War, like, oh, is this Marxist? Is this communist? And so on. I find that students today don't have those kind of hang-ups in actually approaching these ideas. So there's a kind of a freshness and eagerness for these kind of new ways of thinking about the world.
Again, I have had the same experience teaching particularly Walter Rodney in my courses, where students feel that he's jumping off the page, that he's such a fresh voice. For them being exposed to these thinkers who for a moment seemed fixed in time, right? Frozen in time, but in fact, rediscover such dynamism. And I'm glad you mentioned the Cold War, because I think that's another part of the rubbishing of the Third World Project. That's been the dominant narrative of the second half of the 20th century. And one of the, I think, major interventions that you make in the introduction is to talk about the 20th century really as being defined much more about the struggle for equality and for freedom, which is a longer struggle than maybe a more narrow and superpower focused Cold War lens. And you say the Third World preceded and exceeded the Cold War. So maybe you can talk about the intervention that you think you're making and how the Third World Project aligns and stacks up against in a kind of sense of periodization and thinking about the 20th century with regard to the Cold War.
I mean, I think Gian is going to have a lot more to say about this because he's thought long and hard about it. But I'll just very briefly say that one of the efforts of the book is to try to embed the Cold War. It's not to dismiss the Cold War. I mean, the question of socialism looms very large here, and alternative socialisms in the story about the Third World imaginary, but to embed the Cold War in a much longer epic around empire and post-imperial global systems and imaginations. Instead of the reverse, I mean, most historians think, well, there was the Cold War that affected empire and decolonization. Well, what if we turned this around and said, actually, we can't really understand the Cold War outside the context of a much larger centuries-long epic about the ways in which empires, like glaciers, created the structures of the human landscape around the planet. And once we do that, we start to see the Cold War itself totally differently, right? Gian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, I mean, some of the recent work that I've been doing, you know, involved looking at the British Council records and Congress for Cultural Freedom records. And, you know, I was trying to see, okay, so what does the world look like from, you know, Moscow and Washington and so on? And very quickly, it emerged that, you know, in the historiography, the period after Second World War is seen as the kind of epoch of the Cold War, and then Third World kind of fits into that, you know. And even when there are attempts to kind of globalize the Cold War, like in Arne Westad's work, I mean, it only goes so far to say, well, there were global origins of the Cold War, but Cold War remains a kind of a central optic. And as I looked at the materials, and I remember, Jeremy, I don't know if you remember this, this discussion we had when we were writing that textbook, Worlds Together and Worlds Apart, that, you know, eight of us in the history department collaborated on. And there was one of the discussion where some of the Europeanists were saying, we must have a chapter on the Cold War. And some of us were saying, you know, more important is this sort of idea of the third world. And so we actually do have a chapter on this sort of the idea of the third world after the Second World War, in which the Cold War kind of fits in rather than the Cold War being the central optic in which the third world fits in. So,
right. And that chapter is called Three World Order.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so I mean, this was kind of a long-term thinking that, you know, we need to see the world from elsewhere. And the world from elsewhere shows that a kind of, as Jeremy said, a longer struggle for justice and freedom, which is complicated by the Cold War. And in a way, what we need to do is to see the two together, rather than, you know, prioritizing the Cold War and then, you know, fitting third world as a kind of a complicating geopolitics. And the other thing that I want to say is that, you know, what we tried to do is to also uncover the kind of an underground history of the Cold War, because when you see it largely from Moscow or Washington, it seems that many of the actors are mere dupes of the Cold War actors. So, for example, we have a chapter on jazz in Bombay by this journalist Naresh Fernandez, which is really about how the Cold War is actually utilized by local actors to produce something new, because they have ongoing projects. The same thing, you know, Penny Von Ashen does with, you know, these jazz tours in Africa, where so, you know, you have the State Department, which sends these black jazz musicians to demonstrate that, you know, America is not racially divided, you know, and we have these black musicians, but it actually has a different effect in Africa. So there is this whole history of what is then intended by the, you know, superpowers and what actually happens on the ground. And this is also brought out by Jessica Backman's essay, where it shows there's a new kind of a portrait culture that, you know, people in India produce through, you know, photos of Marx, Lenin, Ho Chi Minh, Che, Patrice Lumumba, which, I mean, you could see through Cold War lens, but, you know, I mean, I think it's more useful to see what's happening on the ground, and they're creating some another project, you know, the project of portrait culture. So, I mean, I think there is a whole underground history of the Cold War, which is not related to just the superpowers, but what happens on the ground. And that's what, you know, the volume also tries to bring out.
So in the coda of the volume, and I thought this was a persistent tension throughout the contributions, because as much as it's, you know, it's so interesting to rethink and recover these multiple third world projects and to see these undergrounds and to see these connections, for example, between Yugoslav and Chilean socialist projects, you know, which is, it doesn't come maybe immediately to the surface. At the same time, there's this pervasive tension between the project of the nation state and the need for a powerful centralized state. And at the same time, these projects that are internationally oriented, an international nationalism or a national internationalism, and these connectivities and solidarities. And in the end of the book, there's a coda by Samuel Moyn, and he throws a little bit of cold water, it seems, on the rethinking of the third world. And he says, quote, "Revisiting anti-colonial internationalism poses starkly how ironic and tragic its own self-undoing has turned out." And he's talking about the principle of national sovereignty. How do you respond to that framing of the kind of tragic demise of the third world project?
Well, I mean, one of the things I think, and Kian and I have already started to kind of email and talk about a sequel volume that will have to account for the undoing of it, right? But Sam has put his finger on one of the, you know, the you could call it a tragic paradox, but the point about the self undoing, it dovetails with what Guillaume was just saying. Instead of just seeing the CIA and the KGB overthrowing, you know, third worldist regimes in Guatemala and elsewhere, but to see the internal tensions that are being manufactured by this pursuit of alternatives, I think it kind of moves the story away from purely tragic versus heroic alternatives. And it is worth saying that, that, you know, one of the processes, and I think Guillaume and I mentioned this in the introduction, that's going to emerge in part as an effect of third worldism, will be fourth worldism, will be this other form of critique of state power altogether, coming from feminists, coming from indigenous groups, insurgents in Mexico and India, who are challenging the third worldist regimes, who are calling for state sovereignty and a new international order, and saying, well, we need a new domestic order here. We are not being represented. And this kind of fourth worldist imaginary picks up on some of the languages and the, you know, the assertions about freedom that were inscribed in the post-colonial agenda, and saying, but it's not only incomplete, it's oppressive, right, for us too. That story has really yet to be told, but it is imminent. It's inscribed in the very imaginaries of who gets selected to show up at places like Bandung, right, and who is not. There is a story of repression as well in it, and that we would have to pull that out as well.
Yeah, I mean, and there is a kind of a persistent tension between certain kinds of movements from below and the kind of state capture of the Third World Project. And this happens through various conferences and, you know, big events where state functionaries go and so on. But there is always a, you know, a persistent desire from below of this alternative globalism, which is based on social justice and which is in some way non-territorial. And so, you know, by the time you get to the tricontinental, there is an idea that there can be this kind of a global solidarity, which would be based on some idea of justice against oppression, against capitalism, and so on. So, which is not really territorial and state-based. And, you know, that's very interesting work by Ann Mahler recently on, it's called what, Tricontinental to Global South, where she argues that you can see, if you go back to Du Bois and Global Color Line, you can trace a kind of a connection all the way from there to the tricontinental and see a kind of a persistence about thinking of the world in these kind of non-territorial terms. It has kind of ebbs and flows, but there is a strain of thought. And so, I mean, I think there's a tension between that and state projects, which comes to the fore in the late 60s and early 70s. And now, interestingly now, I mean, you find, for example, echoes of Black Lives Matter everywhere. I mean, I was in India where, you know, when this Modi government introduced this new anti-Muslim Citizenship Amendment Act, there was really ground-level movement led largely by Muslim women, which then adopted the slogan of Muslim Lives Matter. So obviously there is a sort of a connection being made, which harks back to some of the things that, you know, we talk about in the volume of these kind of a transnational, on-the-ground globalism.
I think this the dystopian side of this that you're alluding to, Elisa, that Sam is picking up, is actually very well expressed in Srirupa Roy's chapter in the book about India in the 1970s, that there is a, and that's kind of, that is the last empirical chapter where we begin to see the closure of all of this and the oppressive and the burden of this dreaming that turns to a large extent into a nightmare. That's it. And India is a place for which to think about these wider ways in which the utopian projects were turning very dark and very dystopian.
Well, I was going to ask you what you think remains to be explored about this history, but I think you've just given us lots of new avenues to consider, particularly the dystopian, the struggles from below, and the undoing of the Third World Project. So I think we'll close by asking you each, if I ask you to conjure the Third World, what is the first image or the first icon or the first thing that comes to your mind that captures what you think one aspect of these multiple projects was about?
Jeremy?
One that often gets, and I hear this in my students, one that often gets downplayed, and it's perhaps not as strong in the volume as we might have made, and this is something that other historians can explore more, is the development question, right? We're in a moment where people are trying to think about public goods, about a model of post-carbon intensive economic growth that's fair, that's equitable, and so on. I think if there's something that needs to be that could be even more churned up in this moment is the development experience, and what that all meant and its own trajectories. Development was very, it was key at Bandung, was key in a lot of these conferences. Socialism was a vision for a development process that would industrialize in some way in an inclusive fashion. And so if I would spotlight one dimension of this history that needs more airtime and debate, it would be that one, I think, for the present. In other words, that this is on the minds of a lot of people now about how we reconstruct capitalism, or if some would say even a post-capitalist order, that we could look back at these experiments for some guidance system.
Yeah, I mean, just connected to what Jeremy said, that particularly in relation to the environmental crisis, that one of the things that was brought out very clearly in the recent floods in Pakistan, where one third of Pakistan was, underwater for months, one can't think of a crisis like that without seeing it within the kind of long history of colonialism and how the imagination of another world is, vital for thinking about our present, which, if we can recover from this kind of global environmental crisis, which has this very differential effect on the Third World. That's one of the things that is very striking about as we think about, the present world. And, so it's in that way. And I just recently read an essay by Achille Mbembe, who also speaks about how he says, the jurists, the political scientists, historians have robbed the Third World of its imaginative leap and made it really into, it was about geopolitics and so on. And so as you think about this kind of new world, I think one needs to recapture how the Third World was really an attempt to aspire for a kind of really new world order, which would undo the kinds of things that have led to this present environmental crisis.
So development, environmentalism, and always coming back to these deeper connections of colonialism and global imperialism. Jan and Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this volume. And we look forward to its sequel, The Undoing of the Third World. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.